a poem by Rumi. Inside this new love, die. Your way begins on the other side. Become the sky. Take an axe to the prison wall. Escape. Walk out like somebody suddenly born into color. Do it now. You're covered with thick cloud. Slide out the side. Die. And be quiet. Quietness is the surest sign that you have died. Your old life was a frantic running from silence. The speechless full moon comes out now. Welcome, everyone, to the continuing series in the distortions of mind. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the worried mind. Tonight, we're going to talk about the driven mind. So I thought the poem by Rumi was an appropriate one. Our old life has been a frantic running from quiet. And yet, when we come here, the first thing we do is to take a seat in quietude. Because to be driven by noise, we begin to infer, is no life at all. And some of us are kind of at the edge where noise still plays a vital role in our equation of things. And still has a great deal of input into the image that we carry about ourselves and the storyline that we follow endlessly. And the image that we place upon the quietude of life and then meet life with that quietude through our image. And find ourselves compelled by the image to frantically run from the quiet. And so when we bring a topic to bear like the driven mind, in its extreme, it's a mind that's completely panic-stricken about the goal. But let's look at the continuum, because it's not always the extreme from which we've come. Any goal orientation where there's the sense of being driven so that the process of life is unapproachable is a part of the continuum of the driven mind. And so I think we can all find ourselves on that continuum from time to time. It may not be a strong character pattern until we're a part of the desire system that has extreme need is touched. And then what springs forth is this panic, this drivenness. You know, everything that we do in meditation is about recovering the process of life as opposed to losing ourselves in the goal. Walking meditation is not about where we're walking to. It is about the walking itself. Meditation, sitting meditation, is not about a certain ambition or product from the practice, but rather a relaxation and an embodiment of our life in the moment that we sit. In all aspects of spiritual work, there should be an abiding, a seat that is taken in our life, not in the direction our life is going. Because when we're in our life, the direction is really secondary. But how many of us can manage that? How many of us, after we leave these 2 hours together, even in the drive home, can manage the continuation of the abiding, quality of abiding? Not very many. Why is that? I like to. I'm getting off the subject a little bit, but never mind. Why is that? Why do we lose? And we all have good intentions. And we all ask the question, why is it that I can't maintain this? It's because the very embodiment of the sense of me and you, the sense of I, is the embodiment of the driven quality of life, is the embodiment of the attack dog approach to life. And as soon as we're back into the familiar stimulation, the familiar ground, then everything calls forth our activity and our speed. And even though we begin to understand in the course of practice how speed is a detriment, the word is chosen deliberately, to the abiding, still speed has more importance in our life. Because we seem to get more from it than we do the abiding. We still hear the echoes of our childhood teacher, perhaps, or mistaken adult somewhere along the line that says, you know, idle hands, what's the, idle minds, I don't know, whatever. I can't remember it, but it was intoned in there somewhere. Mischief making or something, I don't know. And the themes of our education, the themes of our parental guidance, the themes, all well-meaning but deliberately intended away from the quietude. It's just, and as the urge towards the goal is encouraged in activity after activity after activity, after a while the blueprint and the direction of our life becomes very substantiated so that it becomes driven. It becomes the intensity becomes its own reward. We have lost the reason why we're doing what we're doing, but the doing, the intensity of the doing becomes its own reward. And the image that has created the doing is now well fixed inside of ourselves. And the image, because it has been created from other people's directedness, other people's teaching us, has never really been in alignment with what our own needs are in that moment, for the most part. Or what other people have told us to be. For the most part, we're what we evaluate in ourselves that other people are and compare ourselves in a in comparison to that, and then march to the step of that comparing. But to align ourselves, even for a moment, to just take that alignment, to take that seat in quietude, something very rich is touched, is it not? Why would we keep coming back to this spot week after week? I'm under no pretense that it's because of me. That something is touched that seems more authentic, more genuine than the driven quality of our life. And the drivenness is from what? You see, we've lost that. We just know that it's out of control. Even though that's the reason we feel that we're doing the reaching and the ambitious striving that we're doing is to gain control. The more we do that, the more out of control our lives is. It's paradoxical, but we don't see the paradox. The faster the running, which is the aim of which was to master and to get things under control, is the very strategy which brings less control. And behind this, the image, the sense of who I am, you see, it's often running, not even, it's lost its original motivation, it's lost its original reason for running. It just runs, and everybody's running, so it's kind of a marathon that we're all looking across, and everybody's out of breath, and we just think, well, that's the state of affairs, if you live, of life. Compulsiveness, the compulsion, the driven goal, it's madness. It becomes so automatic that somehow the speed is connected to the survival of the organism. And the faster we go, the more illusion the power is. We feel more powerful in our speed than in our quietude, and therefore more in control. Don't you? When things are working, when you're beeper's going off and your cell phone is doing something and your Palm Pilot is and you've got some emails and your phone's ringing and you've got lots of mail coming in and the phone's ringing and you're just you know, if all this is going on, I must be important. If I'm wanted this much, if I'm this frenetic, there must be some importance that is linked to this speed. And time then is of the essence. And this is the equation of ignorance. That the faster you go, the more time is precious. More time is precious for the sense of doing more things within it. Not precious for its own sake, but for precious to get more things done. And so we've lost the relationship of abiding in time. Abiding in time. I can't tell you the number of people that say to me, you know, I just can't, I mean, the echo, I hear my mother's voice saying, you're wasting time. Wasting time. You see, when you sit down, you're not doing anything. You feel unproductive. People that have left their work and are not employed anymore feel remiss somehow that they're not fully engaged in life. That somehow our whole sense of being has come from the fabric of our doing. And meditation, I mean, it has to, we have to go, we have to, you see, it tests every conditioning, everything that we lay upon ourselves as fact has to be tested once again in the light of awareness, of the light of what is truly meaningful. And time is one of those qualities. What does it mean to do nothing? The real, someone said, I was listening to the PBS or one of the, I don't know. But someone said on the show, says the quality, the genuine quality of a human being comes out when they have leisure time. what's your real metal, the real essence of you. What do you do with leisure time? What do you do when you're not doing any, when you have nothing to do? Is that a problem for us? To have nothing to do? See, when we're driven, we lose the context. We lose the context of, we lose everything. We lose, we don't just lose the context. The speechless full moon can't come out. And you lose the context, and Buddhism, it's called a clear comprehension, the environment from which the action is taken, the awareness, the expansion, the wholeness of life. When you lose, and it's not just about focusing in on your breath here. It's about the breath of experience. It's about everything, all arising together, including time. If we lose the context, then we've lost the heart. Because within, if it's just about me and what I need, then there's no heart. It's a selfish venture into life. You bring in the context, which can only be brought in when time is not essential. If time's essential, you have a linear relationship to life. This needs to be done to save time. When time is not essential, do you know what I mean by when we're not driven by the clock, then it opens up. It's the only way it can really open up. And then the contextual, the whole of life, the presence of all life, rises together in that opening. It's to pause is to open up. So the remedy of the driven of being driven, I mean, we say it to pause, but we pause as a duration. I've got 1 minute to pause. On the equation of time, this is my time to pause before I get running again. It's not a true pause. A true pause has no boundary. It's not between time moments. It's an opening. True meditation is not 20 minutes taken before your life gets going. It's the reforming. It's the reformat. The reformat. Reforming of your entire life in those 20 minutes. And many of us just bring our busyness into those 20 minutes. Because space, we're saying the same things when we say, you know, stopping, arresting, space, provides options, doesn't it? Instead of just the option of goal orientation, it provides a lot of options. The whole thing opens up to endless options, really, in the moment in which space opens. Do you see? But we have to stop. We have to lay it down. It can't be something we're doing between two other things we're doing. Now, how is space discovered? In the busyness of the day, you see, when we're driven, where we're going from one thing to other, everything has such urgency, the goal is all so important. How do we ever bring space into that in a day that's full of productivity and all of that? Well, exploration. What were the explorers, since time immemorial, doing? They were trying to discover new spaces, new places, new spaces, new openings, new adventures, the unknown. Exploration, in a Dharma sense, investigation is exploration. The willingness to investigate, to look, to question the speed, is space. If we bring a question, what's going on here? Not a psychological question, but an experiential one. The space opens up around the neediness in the question, with the question. But we have to be willing to ask the question. Can ask, you know, what? Now again, when I ask these questions, these are not reflective, analytical questions. These are ones that drop us to the experience of what is, where is space in this moment? Where is space in this moment? And you can ask it from a psychological orientation, but it still provides space. Like, what's driving this? Now you have to be quiet and open to the motivating influence, the image, because some part of one's image is operating in that driven quality. Now I want to show something. I want to show how the driven mind turned back on itself becomes a projection of pressure from others. We say, oh, I'm always pressured at my work. My boss is pressured. My spouse is always, you know, I'm always pressured. And we believe it's from the outside. So I want to show that all pressure is from your drive. Nobody is ever creating pressure for you. They can't. If the drive isn't there, there's nothing that can motivate you to feel pressured. But before I get to the projection, and I'll take you through that in just a minute, the reason that the drive is occurring is that there is an emotional element in me that isn't being acknowledged, and that I've long since lost any reference to. And often that emotional element is associated with a particular image I have of myself, of being intelligent, but I'm not as intelligent as I want to be, so I'm driven to be more intelligent, or I'm more assertive, or more this, or more that, or whatever. Or just a good boy, you know, and somebody gives me a task to do, you know, I've got to, it's not, or perfectionism, or all of, there are 10,000 reasons that our image takes a hold and moves from the pain, no longer referencing the pain of the incomplete feeling that the activity is supposed to relinquish. I need to be a good boy, but inside we don't feel like a good boy. But I need to show everybody that I can do this work, that I'm competent. Inside we don't feel competent. We don't acknowledge the inside quality of incompetence. We just move to the activity to disprove the emotional feeling of the image that we have inside. The point of drivenness is to reclaim ourselves in a different format than our image will allow, to remold ourselves to what we want to be, not to what our belief system is. That's why we feel so compelled to correct the wrong. To correct the wrong. Now, if you're aware, you can feel that. You can feel that. But most of us want to deaden the pain. We don't want to feel the pain. We want to deaden it. And when we deaden pain, we deaden feeling. And many of us are just only partially alive to our feelings. because feelings don't represent they represent the shadow of what I believe myself to be and don't want to be. So drivenness becomes rewarded because it keeps me away from having to feel those feelings. So let's look. I like this. Pressure is a result of projected drive. Okay, this one will, I was ready to do argument with until I examined. Don't tell me my boss isn't creating my hell. Okay, so let's just take an example. I want to go clean my attic. Right? I have put off cleaning my attic for several years. I know there's a lot of accumulated junk and dirt. And so one Saturday morning, I have the motivation, the drive, to go clean my attic. So I venture forth up into my attic, well-intended, clearly in touch with the drive, the need to clean the attic. I get up there and I begin to look around and I see the enormous quantity of mess. Not only do I see the enormous quantity of mess, I also see a lot of things that I like to putter around with up there. So as the hour moves, I find myself kind of looking at old album pictures. And somewhere inside of me, there may be a growing annoyance. The annoyance is that I'm no longer doing what I intended to do up in the attic. And I'm losing touch with the drive that was originally mine to come up and clean the attic. Now it's like, oh, there's another component of me that says, do you really want to do this? And look how hard it's going to be. And, you know. And I'm following that, although I'm staying in the attic, which means that the drive is still active. If the drive were no longer active, I'd go downstairs. I wouldn't be up in the attic. Why would I be up in the attic? But I'm staying up in the attic and puttering. Now I've almost lost contact, connection with the drive that sent me up there in the beginning. In fact, I'm feeling annoyed with myself, and I don't really understand why I'm feeling annoyed. I'm just feeling kind of irritated. But I need someone to hook my annoyance on. So if I'm up there long enough, I'm sure that my wife will call up and say, how's it going, dear? Now I've got my victim. Get off my back. You're always trying to pressure me to do. It had nothing to do with her. She innocently was calling out, wondering how things were going. But because I lost contact with the internal drive to do it and was feeling less and less inclined to do it, although the drive was still active, I was ready to project the pressure onto someone else rather than myself because the drive was no longer aligned with. You see that? Now, suppose she was on my back. Suppose she was of that ilk where she, get going up there, what are you doing up there all that time? Now, we would say, I have a legitimate reason to say she's pressuring me. No, we don't have a legitimate reason. In fact, if the drive weren't in us, no matter what she says, if the drive weren't in me, no matter what she says, wouldn't be a problem. It's the fact that the residue of an unacknowledged drive is there that I have a problem and react to her tone of voice. An unacknowledged drive is felt as pressure from other people. Isn't that interesting? I find that so interesting. And an unacknowledged drive or desire sends us off into obsessive thinking. I was at a yoga conference a couple of weeks ago. They invited me to speak for some reason, because no one showed up to what, well, very few people showed up to what, to my little presentation. But they gave me a free day at the yoga festival. So I went in to this 3-hour class on the esoteric, something about the esoteric chakras of, you know, I don't know. But I thought, oh, that'd be interesting. So I got in there and I met the teacher and we sat down and there were, you know, a lot of people in the room. And she started talking about the different chakras. And she started talking about the characteristics of the different chakras. And she started talking about the colors associated with the characteristics. And she was at the first chakra and she said, oftentimes, people who are fixated in the first chakra wear black. I looked at my shirt and I had a black t-shirt on. I said, oh my God. And I'm sure everybody was looking at me. And having just done my meditation workshop, they're thinking, oh, what, that kid, who wants to practice with that guy? Locked in his first chakra. And I was just, my eyes were going to the floor. And I started obsessing, like, what's it mean? What does it mean I'm in my first chakra? Somebody saved me from my first chakra. I didn't even know what it meant to be in there. And then finally I had the courage to look around and about 50% of the people in the room were in black. And not only that, but I said, well, I have white pants on. Doesn't that moderate the influence of it a little bit? And but the mind started to obsess. It didn't even have any legitimacy towards, I mean, I really didn't even know what it meant to be locked in. But it started to obsess. Oh my God, you know, something's wrong with me. It connected with the motivating energy. And then the motivating energy overpowered the energy. So the thoughts took over, the obsessive thoughts. I've got to correct this, you see. In that moment, I wasn't able to just be with the sense that there's something wrong in me, which is where this particular unskillful, may I say, teaching was directed. And I, you know, instead of just in using it in towards sanity, which, okay, well, there's something wrong there. What's wrong? Nothing. People wear black for other reasons than being locked in the first chakra, for God's sake. This is ridiculous. And but to see the mind getting coiled up in the circuit of thinking, something's wrong with me thinking, and how that spins out in terms of sort of a frenetic pace to try to prove that there isn't anything wrong with me. Now, I didn't get to that, thank God, which meant I would probably have tried to get into the posture she was leading with more perfectionism than I would have otherwise, showing everybody that there's nothing. You see how it moves out into activity just because it's unrecovered. As soon as I recovered it, there was joy. And I wasn't concerned about wearing black. As soon as I recovered it, it's like, oh, there's that old voice again. And when people say, oh, how long does that voice go on? It goes on until it doesn't. Stop the question of time. It has nothing to do with that. It goes on until it doesn't. Release it from your need to have it any other way. And then it opens up. And joy comes in. It's the joy of access. No longer the biting grip of feeling problematic and needing to work out problematically with life, in terms of postures, in terms of psychic energy, in terms of perfectionism, in terms of righteousness, all driven, all driven, the driven mind, all driven from some inaccessible quality in ourselves. And we say, where's joy? Joy is in the middle of that. I can't steer our hearts to joy until we reclaim the projected boundary. Because it is the projected boundary that keeps us from joy. It's the, she's pressuring me. There's no joy in that. As soon as you recover it, the image, and just open the image up to timelessness, not asking when is this image going to go, opening it up to timelessness, then there's joy. Then the heart knows its source, an endless source. It's that boundary. We have to re-own the quality so that we re-own the projection. The symptom was the projection. When we re-own that image that's operating inside of us, the projection no longer encases itself external, out there. It's now invited inward. And joy arises. And the boundary, you see, all boundaries are created from that same thing. When you look out, if you see me and you, that's a boundary. When you look inside and you see things you don't like, psychic parts of your psyche, whatever, that you ward off, that's a boundary, a psychic partition that we plant, that we separate ourselves out from. All the shadow is forms and displays of the tension created from the unwillingness to invite all the pieces in, to hold it all. And we're going to do a series on the shadow not too long from now. Because I think it's a wondrous thing how we create. And so, really, you might say that all of spiritual work has to do with releasing the partitions, the boundaries, the false sense of separation, the boundaries of my body being different than your body. Psychically, me being in here as opposed to you being out there. This being there and that being over there and me being here. All of those are psychic partitions created from the tension of unwanted parts of ourselves. So when we begin to see that, the driven mind, the cue of being driven means that there's something we're running from. Okay, what are we running from? We have to turn around to see what we're running from. It requires not the normal adhering to the display of activity, which was always produced in order to accommodate the wronged part of myself. You know, perfectionism, I center on that one because it's such a disease in this culture and we wink at it like there's something good about it. But it's being driven. It's a driven mind that can't accept fault. Why? Because they can't accept themselves as being faulty or the belief that they are incomplete. We can't hold our own incompleteness. So we're driven to make our activities perfect, to disclaim what we really believe about ourselves. Or need to control. All of the reaching out in its extreme is because of that. I had one yogi, a student at a retreat, who was so meticulous in his sitting, he wanted to get this posture just right, and he was a carpenter, that he brought in a little level, and he had it sitting on his chest, and he would just look down and move his body according so the bubble would fit into the middle. That's a true story. And we bring that into our meditation. And meditation actually can foster the driven mind. Why? Because we get caught up in the focused attention, the need for focused attention, above the need to be alive. And because it's really a nice space to have focused attention. And if you haven't found it, you will at some point in your meditation, and you get to the point where you find this ease of just being on the breath and the mind's not wandering, and the mind states that are engendered through that one-pointedness. But it's one-pointed. It's a mind that has learned how to focus and substantiate what it's focused upon. And I have seen people, myself included, after long periods of that kind of meditation, coming out, and the world doesn't have any breath to it. It's all linear. And so things have exaggerated significance through that linear relationship. So that's what yogi mind is. Yogi mind is making undue exaggerated importance out of anything insignificant. Like, I remember never being more of a hypochondriac than I was on retreat. Every little ache and pain meant I had bone cancer or bladder cancer, because my mind took whatever was arising and made exaggerated significance out of it, captured it. There's no ease of well-being in that. Just neediness. Ease of well-being. Ease of well-being. That's Vipassana romance, is when you see another person who you've never met and you have not only mentally dated them and had a lavish love life and children, and then you meet them and you go, oh my God. But it doesn't stop the mind from making exaggerated significance out of something. Finding the legitimate relationship of all things is the Dharma, is wise view. We're exaggerating significance of my image, because I'm so concerned about my image. I've been so focused on it for all my years. My image. Image is everything, said the television commercial. Now that's a sad statement. The payoff of the driven mind is that it gives you extraordinary meaning and purpose. You find your reason for living within that high caliber momentum of life. Where, as I said, anyone who is under this much pressure must be valuable. Must be. But it's a frantic running from quiet. Frantic running from quiet. So the homework is for you to begin to look at the thoughts and the emotions behind the frantic running from quiet. Play with the feelings of being driven. Over-exaggerate them. If you feel like they're just starting off, over-exaggerate them so that you can begin to, in the exaggeration of them, smile a little bit at them. I need this, I need it. Start beating your hands on the desk and yelling at the top of your voice how much you need it. Just so you start breaking into a smile. And letting, as soon as you break into smile, space is there. Space is more acknowledged. Space is more available. instead of moving impulsively with the driven mind, develop a game plan very slowly and mindfully. Okay? So I often suggested people, you know, who were smokers to just sit down in the same chair and mindfully light a cigarette so that you just know exactly what you're feeling, the smoke go into your lungs. You're feeling the exhale. You're feeling the effect on the body of that smoke. So you're really experiencing the impact, not the high. The high is part of it. Just the impact of that. And I dare say that if people did that for very long, they wouldn't smoke. They wouldn't do anything to the body if they really, uncaringly, if they brought in that sense of space. You can ritualize, plan it out. So that instead of being driven, just stop and develop a game plan for what you're going to do. To give you pause, step one, step two, and then invite yourself, your life, into each step along the way. So that you actually, I don't think that there's, very few of us have the ability just to stop and be present in the middle of a driven mind. We have to have some skillful means to embody our way through it so that we start making this thing a product of our investigation, which can open it to space, which can open it to the timeless, which can open it to the abiding, and thereby break the pattern. But most of us don't have that ability. Our mindfulness awareness just doesn't have the strength for being in the middle of an intense urge to do something without just lashing forth in the doing. And to reflect on your death a little bit. That's a wonderful way to bring some sanity into the driven mind. I never have heard one person say on their deathbed, as I've said before to you, I wish I had worked more hours. I wish I had accomplished more work. No. That's not where the eyes meet death. The eyes meet death in the timeless, in the spaciousness, in the understanding of what they have missed and how they have used their leisure time. So this is an invitation to come back into quiet, into leisure, into the being that the practice focuses upon. This is not a two-hour time. This is a 24-hour practice. This is an abiding practice. Can we sit for a minute or two? Yes, questions? Yes.
You spoke about, when you were talking about being in the attic, about motivation that came from being driven. And I certainly experienced kind of that in my life. But I think I've also experienced a little bit of motivation that that didn't have that same kind of impetus. Can you talk about that kind of motivation, some motivation that's not
What kind of motivation would you be speaking about?
Well, for instance, what I'm thinking about is a few days ago, I've got my parking strip has plants in it and grass is getting protein.
Gave you.
I could think about this in a different way.
Right. Good. So sometimes the question is: sometimes the motivation isn't to be driven. Sometimes there's a motivation in which you see somebody. Doing something that you haven't done before or that you didn't think you had the confidence of, and you can see that it can be done. And so the invitation then is towards confidence rather than towards being ambitious, right? Towards love, really. Towards the flowering of yourself rather than towards the condemning of yourself, which is really what the driven mind does. It condemns you. You're condemned in the driven mind. But towards the expression of heart, to the expression of potential, the broadening of potential, the broadening of capability. So that can also be, I mean, that really, when you do that, then it's not about goal orientation. It's hard for it to be goal oriented with a under pressure to do a goal and to be heart driven at the same time. Because heart driven, a heart quality needs space, it needs expanse, it needs your ease of well-being. It needs your heart, your self-acceptance in order to journey out. So oftentimes when we find ourselves working from that spirit of just, you'll find joy in the middle of that as well. And you can begin to get a sense of what it is that's driving you, whether it's the heart or the mind. Yes. How to what?
You mentioned briefly that one of the difficulties that we all have is accepting incompleteness.
Yes.
And that is something that is very difficult, particularly in
society,
which strives for perfection.
Right. So the question is how most of us feel that incompleteness in a society that strives for perfection. How do you handle that incompleteness? Well, you know, it's the image. Most of our, I mean, an image by its very, behind most people's images, you'll find some sense of incompleteness. In fact, the word dukkha, and often mistranslated as suffering, is much more accurately translated as incompleteness. And that sense of incompleteness in us is a driving force of much of what we do and become. It's image driven. Because if you look at it, you have to understand how it's formed. The mind, in this moment, as it is now, just without any sense of needing to go into the future, doesn't feel complete. It doesn't feel empowered. It doesn't feel substantial. It's not in silence, which is why we run from it. We really don't have a very defined edge. So, in order for our edge to be well defined, we need something in the future to run after. As soon as we're off and running after something in the future, it means that we don't have it now. And therefore, we're incomplete. When we are running, then, therefore, anytime we are time driven, we have to be time driven from a sense of incompletion. Now, when you understand that, then you're willing to go back in and recover your original nature from that incompleteness, which means that you don't run from it to create more doing in opposition to that feeling, which means that you're willing to let the moment hold incompleteness as itself, not as something I need to do to get out of it. Yes, part of it is the memories, which is what has been driving us in the past. Part of it is the fact that we have been told and compared ourselves all along, which has just fed this whole sense of my image, the story of me, needing some kind of resolution in the future. Right? And so the present moment is never acknowledged, because the present moment, we feel that incompleteness, one, but we also feel less substantial and less empowered, which reinforces that sense of incomplete. So from the past memory into the future is where our momentum goes, and we carry that experience forward in time. So the resolution, although the problem may have been gendered in the past, the resolution is always in the future.
I spent the weekend with my 88-year-old father who is dying, and I went there thinking that I could offer him something, and he barely has any muscle mass left. But he decided he wanted to go for a walk, so he took his walker and he got about halfway around the block, and then he wanted to show me a bridge. And we started going up over this walking bridge, and we could only go like 10 feet and it stops. And I don't think I've ever experienced that feeling with him before, because he was always a driven man. And he forced me to slow down and be with him and just be. I mean, it's not like we have a lot to talk about. Going across a field and over a bunch of construction. It's just like it took us almost 3 hours to get back to the house.
Right.
And my mother was frantic.
Right.
Did
you feel the relationship come in there?
Yes.
You see? You know, if you were, often, and the question has to do with being with his grandfather, who was a driven man his whole life, but now that he's terminally ill, that he has slowed down, and the journey is